Today, author and educator Craig Biddle visits the Foxhole. Craig Biddle is the co-founder and director of education at the Objective Standard Institute, editor of the Objective Standard Journal, and executive director of the Prometheus Foundation. He is the author of Loving Life, The Morality of Self-Interest and the Facts That Support It, Rational Egoism, The Morality for Human Flourishing, and the forthcoming Moral Truths Your Parents, Preachers, and Teachers Don't Want You to Know. He is currently working on his fourth book, Thinking in Principles. Hi, Craig.
Hi.
It's great to have you here.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
All right. Can you tell us briefly how you were introduced to objectivism and Ayn Rand's ideas?
Yeah, so my first career was actually as a furniture designer and furniture maker.
Wow.
I was not an academic in school, and I actually majored in fine art in college, and did so and largely because I'm dyslexic, and I just reading was always very difficult and fatiguing, so I tried to stay away from anything involving books and went through fine art school with a concentration in furniture design, started a business designing furniture, and had been doing that for a few years when I was delivering a bookshelf to one of my customers, and we were taking the books off the old shelf to bring in the new, and I saw a copy of The Fountainhead, which I had heard about from my younger brother, who was at the time in architecture school. And he had said to me, "Craig, you got to read this book. You would love it." But he also knew that I was not a reader. And so it was kind of just, you know, tongue in cheek almost that he was making that suggestion. But because I had heard of it and because he had spoken so highly of it, and the customer saw me looking at the book, and she was like, "Oh my God, have you never read that?" And I said, "No, you know, my brother recommended it, but I haven't read it." And she insisted that I take it home and read it. So I humored her and took the book home, and not that I really intended to read it. It's just not something that I did. But anyway, for whatever reason, that weekend, I cracked the book and just started reading the first page. And for the first time in my life, I couldn't put it down. So this is how I discovered Rand. And I read very slowly because of the dyslexia. So it took me a long time to get through The Fountainhead, but I couldn't put it down. And I just read and read and finally got through it. And I was blown away. Howard Rourke was just such an amazing character and an immediate hero to me. So then I dove into her other works, starting with the Virtue of Selfishness and then Atlas. That's the order. First three books that I read were in that order. And then I just spent my evenings for the next few years. I would make furniture during the day and deliver stuff to customers and this, that, and the other. And in the evenings, I basically spent my time reading Ayn Rand's works and taking Leonard Peikoff's courses and basically just doing everything I could to understand this philosophy. So that's my introduction and how I came to the ideas.
And you were doing this while you were still creating and making furniture?
Yes. So I had a fairly large group of friends at the time when I first met or first discovered Ayn Rand's ideas. And I basically just withdrew from all of those social engagements because I became so fascinated by these ideas that I didn't want to do anything else but read and study them. They were just blowing my, you know, when you first discover Rand, if you're really paying attention to what's going on there, it's mind-blowing how clear her writing is, how concretized it is, how obviously true it is, even though it's running against almost everything you've been taught, particularly in ethics, but in so many other areas too, aesthetics and you know, also deeper epistemology and metaphysics. And so that fascinated me. I was actually raised in a fairly left family, a way left family. My father and mother were basically, I mean, they supported McGovern for goodness sake. So there's that. Wow. And my father's an Episcopal minister, or was at the time. He's retired now. But so I was raised in a family that was very left-leaning in its politics, and that also had an undergirding of Christian religion and the morality that comes with that, which, of course, is altruism.
Yes.
So in discovering Rand, everything that she was saying was contrary to what I had you know, been raised to believe. Now, my parents were not the, you know, beat you over the head with the Bible type of people. And my parents were very loving, good people.
Sure.
My mother has now passed, but my father's still alive. And I had a very nice childhood in terms of parents. So I didn't come from some really horrific, unfortunate background, but I had really bought into altruism. I mean, I really, really thought that morality equals sacrificing for others. That's just what it meant in my mind. And to see Ayn Rand undo that so masterfully, particularly in The Virtue of Selfishness, and to realize to some extent, not fully initially, but to realize to some extent the implications of this, right? Oh my God. Mm-hmm. Sacrifice is not good. It's immoral, and self-interest and the pursuit of values and non-sacrificial pursuit of values. That's what's moral. I mean, that just changes everything, right? It changes everything in your life. That's how I got in. And those were the first books I read. And, you had asked about, whether I was just designing furniture and studying Rand. Yeah. For about 4 years, that's all I did.
So, okay. Yeah. Now, I'll just intercede here for a second. When I was first introduced to the Fountainhead, it's like the cobwebs just got blown out of my mind. And, it just reached the deepest part of me. So that is still my favorite novel, even though Atlas is like 1A, if you will. So yeah, the Fountainhead is who I've always introduced other people to first. I've used that as like the go-to novel when I became a flame spotter, if you will. And when I see someone who's bright and also a reader, I say, have you ever heard of Ayn Rand? And they'll say no. And I said, well, here, and then they just devour all the novels. And I've only had over the years, I've only had like one person like, but everybody, I'd say about 35 people have just been grateful to me that that I introduced her to them. But anyway.
Great work, Blair.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you. So as you're going along, and did you attend any conferences? What gave you the initiative or the drive to start the journal?
Oh, yeah. So a lot happened between my discovery of Rand and the beginning of the Objective Standard. So we launched the Objective Standard. We formed the journal in 2005, and we launched the first issue in 2006. But I discovered Rand in about 1989, 1990, right in there. Mm-hmm. And so what happened between there is pretty significant and pretty odd, actually. So here I am designing furniture. And I don't have any academic background. I'd taken whatever the requisite courses were in college to get through. I mean, even if you're majoring in fine art, you still have to take English and math and
sure.
Academic courses. But I just sort of squeaked through those and got focused on my art. And while studying Rand's works in the evenings during those years, I just fell in love not only with the ideas, but with her ability to communicate them clearly. And I became so impressed with her communication skills, hers and Leonard Peikoff's, because I was taking his courses too. And I'm sure you guys have listened to Leonard's courses.
Yep. Oh yeah,
they're just so beautifully structured. Yep. Yeah, he's just such a master educator. And so I fell in love with this whole new approach to teaching with such clarity. And I wanted to do that. I kept feeling like that's what I want to do with my life. I love these ideas so much, and I want to share them with other people. I want to learn how to communicate them really well, like Ayn Rand and Leonard do. Now, that's obviously kind of a ridiculously high bar, but I'm an ambitious person, so I set it and went for it. I don't think I'll ever get anywhere near their ability to communicate these ideas, but it's a nice goal to have. So that's
Yes, it is.
So what I did is I wanted to figure out, well, how am I going to find time to learn how to write and communicate, right? That's a big thing. I've got to do that in addition to really, really grasping this philosophy. You can't communicate it if you don't understand it. So I had a lot to do, and I figured, well, I'm not making enough money with furniture design, and this business that I'm running takes so much time. I was working very, very long days to keep myself, you know, keep my bills paid and all. So I thought I would start a new business, a business that would maybe really generate some income and buy me some free time. And I was going to open an indoor rock climbing gym because that was my hobby at the time. And rock climbing gyms were popping up all over the country and doing quite well. It's a lucrative business if you run it well. So I had written a business plan and was going to open a gym. I had some partners. And one of the guys we sent the business plan to was a wealthy real estate developer, a guy named Sidney Gunst, who's one of my good friends now. And he read the plan and sent me, actually he called me and he said, I've read your plan. I want to talk with you. Can you meet me for lunch? And I was like, oh, awesome. So, you know, I figured I was going to meet with Sidney Gunst and he was going to basically fund this thing. We had raised some funding, but we still needed another about $250,000, $300,000 to get it off the ground. Mm-hmm. And I figured Sidney was going to be the ticket to that. We go out to lunch and he immediately tells me that he has no interest in funding my rock climbing gym. literally. And he says, I said, well, why did you ask me to lunch? And he goes, because this plan was so well written that I want to hire you to come help me write some business plans. I just liquidated a bunch of my real estate assets and trying to get into some new ventures. And I need somebody who can write like this. And I was like, well, I don't like writing business plans. I don't want to do that. So we had this sort of fun adversarial conversation about, you know, he wanted me to do this and I wanted to do that. And to make a very long story short, he started asking me what my hobbies are other than rock climbing. Clearly I was into that, but he said, why do you want to open a climbing gym? What's your ultimate goal in life? And I told him that I wanted to write. I wanted to write about philosophy. And as Sid likes to tell the story, he didn't literally say this, but it was the gist of it. His response was, philosophy? Who needs it? You know, and for those who don't know, that's the title of one of Ayn Rand's books, Philosophy, Who Needs It? And so we just got into this really fascinating conversation and he made me an offer. And the offer just sounds too good to be true, but this was the offer. You come to work for me and help me write two business plans and I will pay you to write your first book. I'll put you on salary and you just write your first book. And that's how you can. So you don't need to open your climbing gym to get to that ultimate goal. You just need to come work for me.
Nice.
And when something sounds too good to be true, you have to be really careful. So I said, well, look, thank you for the offer, but this sounds kind of silly. I'll tell you what, you read this book, Atlas Shrugged. And if you are in full agreement with me that it's by my coming to write my book, I can write from the perspective of this philosophy without any interference at all from you. Like I need to be able to say what I think in the book without any strings attached. And if you, after reading this book, say yes to that, then yeah, I'll do that. I'll come write some business plans for you and do this thing. So he starts reading Atlas. And this is a businessman, a very successful businessman. And businessmen typically have to be pragmatic, not in the philosophic sense of the term, but sort of in the sense of meaning just practical, right? You've got to deal with government regulations. And if you're a real estate developer in particular, this is back when environmentalism was really kicking in. And so they kind of have to act in this pragmatic way of where you compromise here and there to get by and get things done. And he starts reading Atlas and he's just blown away by these ideas. And by the time he gets through Galt's speech, his mind is just, you know, on fire. He finishes the book and he is as blown away by the ideas as I was after reading the book. And we just formed this bond of friendship and camaraderie and intention. And he not only was now interested in me writing the business plans and then funding my book, he was really interested in the book. Right. Like he was like, oh my God, these ideas are so important. And he liked the way that I communicated. So he thought that I had real potential to do that. And we struck a deal and I sold the business plan to my partners, stepped out, went to work for Sid, started writing my first book. That took about 5 years to write because I went through multiple iterations of utter failure and horrible writing. I had to learn how to write at the same time I was learning the philosophy. But by the time I published that in 2002, Sid and I had started a small company called Life Logic Company, where we had employed about five people who were doing other projects. One was on parenting, one was on the history of philosophy, and several other projects, none of which the only real product that came to fruition out of all of that was my book, Loving Life. But then after a few years after that, my first book came out. So that came out in 2002. In 2005, we were at an Objectivist conference in San Diego, and we were chatting about the possibility of, Sid and I were sitting with some other people, we were chatting about the possibility of a journal written from an objectivist perspective. And I was already working on another book, but this really intrigued me because there was no journal at the time. The intellectual activist had basically stopped publishing.
Yeah.
No journal about these ideas at the time. So Sid got excited about it and said he would put up the seed money if I would do the editing. And I thought the editing was going to be, you know, sort of a part-time job where I just, you know, dot the I's and cross the T's and whatnot. And I agreed to do it, thinking that I'd be able to continue writing my book on the side. And turns out that starting a journal is not a part-time job. It's quite a bit more than a full-time job. So dove into that, and we launched, published our first issue in 2006, spring of 2006, and have been publishing regularly. And, you know, I think really interestingly ever since. I love the journal and I love the people that write for it. And it's just a really exciting business to be in because we, as you know, we do a quarterly, but we also have articles coming out along the way that we
do. Yeah.
So that's how I got from learning it, to, you know, discovering RAND to where the journal came about.
Great story. And thanks very much for sharing this. Because I've been involved in a magazine called Lyceum Magazine, and we translated objectivist material into Swedish, and we were attending book fairs and so on, and also subscribed to your journal. So it's fascinating. And as I said, in the green room here, how much I love your book on loving life. So it's fascinating to hear your story about this.
Now, after 14 years of steady publishing, and congratulations, who had did you have the idea for the Institute, or who approached you about that?
Yeah, so this is a whole nother, my wife likes to say that I love to do things I have no idea how to do, and I just dive in head first, and it's kind of the story of my life. But yeah, running the Objective Standard Journal has been, it's been a pleasure in the sense that I love the work, and I really find a lot of meaning in all that we do there. But it's also been really hard because there's not a big market for these ideas. And we don't, you know, I think we write very clearly and in a way that's accessible to laymen, but it still rubs everybody the wrong way. I mean, it's at war with everything they learned in Sunday school and in their high school, quote, science class, which was all about environmentalism and, you know, this, that, and the other. So it's hard to get people to pay for a journal that focuses on these ideas. There also have been some skirmishes within the objectivist movement that have been made things difficult for the journal at times. And so we realized we got to do fundraising in addition to selling subscriptions in order to keep the journal going. So we started doing that in about 2009, 2010. And then we started doing conferences. In 2018, we held our first summer conference, TOSCON, TOSCON. And then the theme is always philosophy for freedom and flourishing. And we ran a really successful 2 years of that conference, 2018 and 2019. And while we were doing that, we were like, you know, this is a whole nother thing we're doing here. This is teaching philosophy, not just writing about it from an objectivist perspective. So there's journalism and then there's education. And, you know, there's some intersection between these things, but they are distinct. And it occurred to us, and this is mostly my wife, Sarah, was thinking, you know, we really ought to think about breaking this into another organization that takes over the education part. And a good friend of ours, Pete Masterson, who does the covers for the Objective Standard, heard this idea and really loved it and started saying, yeah, you guys need to start a nonprofit because A, you're already doing those kinds of things, the conference. And I was teaching writing courses privately for nothing, you know, for no compensation in the evenings to various people who write for the journal. So that's another thing that we were doing that was already strictly educational. And it occurred to us, you know, we ought to start an educational 501c3 and really take off with the education stuff in another direction that is consistent with and really dovetails with what the journal is doing. So we did some research to find out what this was going to take, and we decided to do it. And November 2019 is when we filed for incorporation for the nonprofit, and we announced it in, I think, May of 2020, and started teaching courses in June, and we've been doing that ever since. And it's been it's been really wonderful coming out of the gate. We've taught, I think, something around 140 unique students since June. And I believe it's been 9 or 10 unique courses since then. And I say unique courses because in some instances, we've taught the course more than once. In multiple instances, we've taught the same course more than once. And these are live online courses, of course, because of COVID, where everything is online.
Sure, okay.
But we've been doing that, and many of the courses have sold out. We have a 15 or a 20-person limit, depending on the writing courses have a 15-person limit, and the other courses have a 20-person limit. And we've sold out in many instances. And we've just got all sorts of plans now to expand this. The way I think of OSI is it's sort of like the great courses company, but with objectivism woven in as sort of the thread that integrates everything and that undergirds everything and that shows how it is that philosophy is practical. It helps us to think better and to act in more life-serving ways and to live better. And the purpose of the Objective Standard Institute is to implement what we call a value-up approach to learning philosophy in general and objectivism in particular. And that what that means, you normally have a contrast between a top-down approach and a bottom-up approach, right? And those are the ways that people think. And typically people say the bottom-up approach is better. I agree, but I think there's something more specific in what we call our value-up approach, which is that we like to meet people at their legitimate values. So, you know, if they have an interest in education or in art or in learning economics or in entrepreneurship or whatever, you meet them there and say, oh, you want to do this thing or you want to learn more about this or engage in this way. And then we say, wonderful, we have these great ideas that can help in this regard. And we bring in principles from philosophy and from objectivism in particular. And by bringing these in and explicitly talking about what they are and how they apply to this field, you are meeting people at their values and showing them that it's in their self-interest to engage in philosophy and to understand these ideas, which, of course, is appealing to the proper motivation anyway. I mean, we're egoists, right? So people should be motivated only by that which is good for their life. If it's not good for their life, why would they want to get involved? So I love the model that we're working on, which is this value-up approach. And our students so far and participants have just loved it. Many, many of the people, I said we've taught about 140 unique students, but many of those students have come back from, you know, second, third, fourth courses. So that's what we're doing. And it's, you know, we're still trying to figure out how to do this thing. We went ready, launch, set. and that's where we are now. We're trying to, it's like we've got a tiger by the tail because it's taken off and it's doing really well, but we also are still trying to figure out how to do it. So
that's great. Well, my next question was, you know, what's the purpose of OSI? But you just explained it with your value up approach. I think kind of covers that.
I could be a little more specific.
Go ahead.
Our mission, I think, is interesting because it's an interesting way to hear what we do. And of course, you know, we worked long and hard trying to figure out exactly what we want to do. And it's wrapped up in this mission statement. So the purpose of OSI is to teach the rising generation about the importance of philosophy, the principles of objectivism, and related ideas for living fully and defending liberty. So there are a few parts here. The rising generation, so our target market is basically young adults. Now, sure, we're not opposed to older people coming in and enjoying it, and a lot do. But, you know, we're trying to, you know, as you know, most people when they get beyond about 30 are not really going to change their fundamental ideas on things anyway. I mean, some people do, but it's pretty rare. We're trying to reach people who are still in their formative years in terms of philosophically formative years. So that's the target market. We want to introduce them first and foremost to the importance of philosophy, not first and foremost to objectivism, because if philosophy doesn't matter, then objectivism doesn't matter. So it's got to be the case that philosophy matters in order for it to be the case that a particular philosophy matters. So that's the first thing in the mission statement is the importance of philosophy. And the second thing is the principles of objectivism. And the reason we say the principles of objectivism rather than just objectivism is because we don't introduce people typically, although we will have some courses that are actual introductions to objectivism. But what we're really doing is introducing people to principles of this philosophy that relate to something that they're interested in. And they learn a little bit about the principles and how they apply before they learn the whole thing. It's just more of a piecemeal approach to learning the ideas. Okay. And so that's why objectivism comes in the middle there. And then the third part of the statement is, and related ideas for living fully and defending liberty. Well, why this? Because Ayn Rand's not the only person who ever came up with good ideas about living fully and defending liberty, right? There are other people, Auburn Herbert, to just take one example, or the Founding Fathers to take another, or John Locke to take another, right? Yeah. There are lots of people, or great self-development thinkers from Dale Carnegie to James Clear to Dan Sullivan, right, today. So, or Cal Newport, right? Wonderful, really, really rich thinkers in these areas. So what we want to do is we want to integrate objectivist philosophy and fundamental philosophic understanding of what the world is, how it works, what's our place in it, what's right and wrong, all of the questions that philosophy answers, with practical ideas for making your life wonderful and defending the political conditions that are necessary for us to make our lives wonderful. So that's sort of the whole package. And so that's the mission of the organization, is to introduce the rising generation to or help them understand the importance of philosophy, the principles of objectivism and related ideas for wonderful living and defending liberty. So this really gives us the very broad palette to work with. We can have courses, as we do, on everything from how economics integrates with objectivism to how objectivism integrates with and helps in entrepreneurship, to the principles of good communication from an objectivist sort of pedagogical or epistemological perspective, and how those apply to good writing in defense of liberty. We've got a really popular course titled How to Write Powerfully in Defense of Liberty that's based on that. So you see how it really is. It's like the great courses company, but with objectivism as this integrating thread running through.
That's fantastic.
And Craig, I think you have done a great job there also with your podcasts, also presenting this in a nice way, so you could chew it and then you could learn from what you have interest in. And talking about the principles and also that philosophy is important, and here in the foxhole, seeing what's going on in the world, do you get interest from individuals that have had the upbringing that, religion is the yardstick, or fundamental ideas are linked to religious ideas? Have you seen anything with young individuals there, or with the target market?
Oh, yeah. I mean, almost everyone is under the impression that if morality exists and is objective, then it has to come from religion. It has to come from, a super being, God, who tells us what's right and wrong, and that's what makes it objective.
Is that a North American thing? Because as I said, I am American in spirit and studied and worked in America, but I am located in Europe, in Scandinavia.
And it certainly is a North American thing, but I think it's broader than that too, because even if people don't explicitly think that morality must come from religion if it's going to be objective, if you start pressing them for, all right, well, if it doesn't come from God, how is it going to be objective? Isn't it just going to be, some form of relativism? Well, you like to do this, he likes to do that. Who's to say what's right? Where are the facts? This gets to the whole is-ought dichotomy, right? How do you derive moral principles, oughts, from the facts of reality, from what is? And dating all the way back to the sophists in ancient Greece, the idea was you can't. The sophists famously said, might makes right. How do you know what's right? Whoever can lord it over the others and say what's right gets to say what's right. Well, that's subjectivism, right? And all the way on through David Hume, the British philosopher who really popularized the is-ought dichotomy, he held that and wrote that you cannot derive a moral principle and ought from the facts of reality, from what is. Now, a lot of people debate about whether, because he used the word deduce, at least in one of the most famous instances where he's talking about this. But in his time, deduce and derive, or deduce and induce, didn't have a huge difference in the common parlance. And it's accepted by most scholars that he really meant, and the context of the rest of his books actually supports this, that he really did mean you can't get moral principles from the facts of reality. You just cannot get an ought from an is. And most people believe this. So this leads us back into the issue of morality. Well, if you can't get morality from observation and logic, from facts, then the only place to get it is from revelation and faith. And this dovetails with the whole long-held idea that morality comes from religion. And I know of very few people, I don't know of anyone, unless they've discovered objectivism and they know about how Ayn Rand derived moral principles from the facts of reality. I don't know of anyone who can tell you how to do that. You hear Sam Harris taking a whack at it. You hear Michael Shermer and others taking a whack at it, but they don't get it. The best that they do is Sam Harris says, well, morality has to be based on well-being, because what else would it be based on? And then, but he doesn't go the full depth that Ayn Rand goes down to, you know, life being conditional and being the only thing in the world that can go out of existence. And, you know, her whole grounding for the objectivist ethics. And the reason that other thinkers typically don't go there, and that so many people are still confused on it, is because of what Ayn Rand called the fallacy of the frozen abstraction. Everyone has in their mind that morality equals altruism. So when they go looking for morality in reality, they're not looking for morality. They're looking for a specific kind of morality, namely the one they were raised to believe is true, altruism. But here's the problem. There are no facts of reality that support the idea that you should sacrifice for other people. There just aren't. You can go looking for them, but you're not going to find any facts that say that, that imply that. And so people really are confused. They think if morality means altruism, then you really can't get it from reality. So where are you going to get it from? You're going to get it from supernature. You're going to get it from God. So yeah, I've encountered you asked whether I had encountered people who have this mindset. Frankly, I don't think I've encountered anybody who doesn't have this mindset, even if they don't know that they have it. Maybe they've not done the thinking through, but if you were to sort of have a conversation with people and try to fold back the layers of the onion, you would get them down to, yeah, I can see how, you know, morality's either got to be subjective, or if it's going to be objective, it's got to come from a God. And then you're at this weird position that, all right, well, so if there is no God, then anything goes, which the opening line from my book, Loving Life, because that's where people's heads are. So, yeah, we get that all the time. And one of the things that we try to do is to get people to start thinking in a whole new direction, the way that Ayn Rand did, about do we need morality at all? If we need it, why? And you start asking the right questions and you can start to see why Ayn Rand's approach to this subject and ultimately her conclusions in this subject are correct.
Thanks.
Yeah, fascinating. That's excellent.
We have to see the light. And there you had Blair asked about this other organization. Could you tell a bit more about that, Craig?
Prometheus Foundation, yeah.
So we'll Prometheus, get the light and the fire.
Yeah, I will. But before we move on to Prometheus, Martin, you asked, you mentioned the podcast. Yeah. And I wanted to just say a word because Objective Standard Institute actually has three programs that we run. We have our courses, which I've mentioned. We have podcasts. We currently have three and we have more coming. And one of them is Philosophy for Flourishing. The other one is The Hero Show. And the third is Culture and Causation. And I do the Philosophy for Flourishing with John Hersey. I've been so busy that we have not, we intended that initially to be weekly, but my schedule has been such that I can't do that. So that's been more of a sort of a bi-weekly.
That's good. Show. That's all good. I hear you.
but The Hero Show has been weekly since it began a few months ago. And that's with Andrew Bernstein and John Hersey. Really wonderful show. They'll pick some hero from history and just sort of tell his or her story. And it's really just an inspiring, wonderful, upbeat show. So I really encourage people to check that out. And then Aaron Briley, fellow at Objective Standard Institute, runs a podcast called Culture and Causation. And this is mostly focused on sort of helping to bring, talking about ways to bring Ayn Rand's ideas into inner city contexts. You know, people who are, you know, in the middle class or upper class in society have all sorts of opportunities to come across Ayn Rand's ideas because, you know, they're basically in, you know, relatively good schools, and maybe they go to college, and, you know, and they're savvy on the internet, so they can do research to try to figure things out. So people like the three of us on this call, we're pretty inclined to at least come across Rand's ideas at some point in our life. But if you're an inner city kid, poverty stricken area, not that there's a whole lot of poverty, but relatively speaking, sort of a poor area within Chicago or something like that, and you're in a rotten, really, really rotten public school there, chances of you ever hearing about Ayn Rand are pretty slim. But this is really a tragedy, because these are human beings just like we are, and they have minds just like we do, and they're capable of thinking just like we are, but yet they don't have this opportunity, sort of to use the common parlance. We have this privilege, right, to some extent here. And in this case, it's genuine that we have a privilege in a context where we might come across these ideas. And Aaron really wants to put on the gas in trying to bring Ayn Rand's ideas into the conversation with people who are concerned about inner city and minority contexts, so that some of these young people who otherwise would never hear about Ayn Rand, or might not hear about her until they're in their 30s, at which time, you know, they're probably not going to change their thinking, might hear about them sooner. So that's I'm a little long-winded on this particular podcast, because it's a really unique one in this regard. I don't know of anybody else doing what Aaron is doing there. And he's interviewed people like he interviewed Walter Williams several weeks before Dr. Williams passed away. He's interviewed Heather McDonald, and, you know, some pretty
heavyweights. Yeah.
So there's that. There's those podcasts. And then the third thing that OSI does is our conference, our summer conference, which it took over from the Objective Standard Journal. And that's TOSCon. And this summer, it's going to be in Boston in July, and we have just an amazing lineup coming together. There's some Cal Newport just signed on. He's going to be speaking. Mm-hmm. He's the author of Deep Work and Digital Minimalism. Yeah, really, really great thinker. And we've got a few other people that will be announced soon. I'm not at liberty to announce them yet, but we've got some really, really big news on who's going to be at that conference. And so those are the three things. And OSI does the courses, the podcasts, and these conferences, at least for now. We have other ideas in the mix, but those are the three main things.
Great.
Now, great. Prometheus Foundation, Blair, you mentioned this.
Yes.
Yeah, this is a really interesting situation, too. So my good friend and partner of sorts at this point, Carl Barney, who has been funding Objectivist projects since the 1980s, since the early 80s.
Yes.
You know, he's just a very successful businessman who's got a lot of wealth that he would like to, he calls it frozen energy, and would like to place it in the hands of people who are capable and will do good work to advance Ayn Rand's ideas throughout the world. And it's a fairly large fund, and he had been doing most of the thinking about who to give money to and making the decisions on his own until a couple of years ago, when he realized, you know, this is just too big a job for one guy to do. I need a board of directors. I need a team. I need somebody to take this over, because he doesn't want to live, you know, the rest of his life. As he puts it, he spent the early part of his life making all this money, and he doesn't want the rest of his life to be a burden trying to figure out how to give it away.
Okay.
So he's like, as he puts it, he's like, Craig, I have a problem. The problem is I have a lot of money. I don't know what to do with it. And he's, you know, he's one of these guys. He doesn't have a taste for airplanes and yachts and whatnot. It's just not his thing. He's funny because he's such a wonderful man. He's really frugal with his money. Ostentatious guy. He does what he wants to do. He doesn't have these big, showy hobbies and whatnot. He wants to advance Ayn Rand's ideas because they helped him so much in life, and that's what he wants to do. So he pulled together a board, and I was on the awards committee for Prometheus Foundation starting about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And then I was invited to be on the board, and I said yes. And so I was on the board of directors. And while I was on the board, the board realized that they needed to find an executive director to really take over. So we, you know, we put out some feelers and some advertisements for that, and we got some applications, and the board looked at the applications, and there were some really good people on there, but they had somehow started to see me as the right person for that position. Mm-hmm. And so they asked me, would I take it? And I first laughed because I was like, are you kidding me? I'm, you know, I'm already very, I mean, we had the idea of Prometheus found of Objective Standard Institute was now already underway. So I was taking on this whole new venture, and they were asking me if I would also be the director of this new foundation. So I initially was like, oh, look, I can't do that. And then they said, well, look, what if we hire someone to sort of work with you and be your right-hand man or right-hand gal, as it turned out. And we came to an agreement that I would step in as executive director, and that Annie Wintersands, my really good friend over in the Netherlands now, would be my right-hand person, and she would be the director of operations. And so she does most of the administrative work, and that enables me to just sort of deal with the high-level decision-making and communications with the board and the awards committee and whatnot. So I did. I stepped in, and we do that now. Okay. The fascinating thing about these three organizations, the Objective Standard, Objective Standard Institute, and Prometheus Foundation, is if you think about what each one does. So the Objective Standard writes about and publishes articles about cultural, philosophic, and political issues, mostly cultural and philosophic, from an objectivist perspective. So if you want to read really fascinating articles from an objectivist perspective about all sorts of subjects, from art to history to economics to politics, you can read about it there. If you want to learn about philosophy, if you want to take courses on the subject about philosophy in general, or about objectivism in particular, or about other ways to integrate really good, powerful ideas with deep philosophic ideas so that you can make your life better or help you defend liberty better, Objective Standard Institute is there for you for that. If you already understand these ideas substantially and you want to help advance them, then Prometheus Foundation is ready for you to come over there and give us a proposal where you say, look, here's what I'd like to do. And we're open to all sorts of proposals. You go, so anyone who's interested can go read on our website the kinds of things that we fund. But we now have we fund organizations and individuals all over the planet, Ukraine, Dubai, Singapore, UK, all over the United States, South America. We have organizations and individuals that we're funding just in this huge, what we call the Prometheus Network. And that is just a network of people and organizations that are working to advance Ayn Rand's ideas. And they're getting some funding from Prometheus Foundation. And we really encourage everyone in that network to work together, to learn from each other, to leverage off of each other, to share each other's, you know, successes and failures so that we can all learn and level up. And it's just a really great synergistic, you know, perfect storm in the good sense of that, if you will, between these organizations. So those are the three things that I have my hand and, well, I should say my whole body and head into at this point.
Wow. Can a fledgling podcast called The Secular Foxhole join the Prometheus Foundation?
You can certainly put in an application. Now, we do have, and you'll see this if you go to the website, there are some limitations on things. Like we are no longer, we funded a few books, but we're not doing that anymore because we don't want to fund the writing of books. We're happy to fund if a book is really good and it's already written. We're happy to hear, to see proposals about funding the marketing of that book to help market it. But we stopped funding books. We lean away from funding podcasts. Now we have funded some to some extent, and you can always make a proposal to that effect, but that's not the kind of thing that we typically fund. So,
okay. I had to ask.
Yeah, well, you know, it's worth asking. Go check out the website. I wouldn't say don't submit a proposal, but just be aware that it's not necessarily one of our favorite kinds of things to fund. What we love to fund are any efforts to get people to do real deep dives in the form of taking courses, either Leonard Peikoff's courses or other courses that some of which are being taught live nowadays, to really get people to help people do a deep dive and really chew on these ideas so that they really grasp the philosophy. The other thing we love to fund is things like book study groups, where people do a deep dive on, you know, OPAR or on Ayn Rand's works or whatever. Those are the things we're most interested in. Or an organization that might start in, you know, we just funded an organization in Ukraine, the Objective Center Ukraine, that's going to be teaching courses and doing whatever they can there to advance Ayn Rand's ideas. So those are the kinds of things that we typically.
I see.
That's great to hear. It's like going back in history when my interest in Rand's ideas in around 85, and when we're starting the campus clubs and also the magazine. So, and also we're spreading the good word here around the globe, as you say. So thanks for sharing this, Greg, and we'll look into it because Blair and I, we have some future plans and ideas also. So thanks for that input.
My pleasure.
Craig, and we're approaching 50 minutes, so I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but I'd love to discuss Loving Life, your first book. Can you extrapolate a little bit on thinking and principles and the one previous to that about what your preachers and teachers don't want you to know?
Yeah, so both of these books, both the moral truths your parents, preachers, and teachers don't want you to know, and thinking and principles have been, well, the first of those, the one about parents, preachers, and teachers, that's really just a revised version of a long article I published in the Objective Standard several years ago, which in that version was titled Egoism for Teenagers or something. Like, I don't remember the title that we gave it there. I'm very forgetful about those kinds of things. But anyway, I wrote an article about rational egoism for teenagers, basically. And the idea, not that there's a different morality for teenagers, but it was an introduction to this morality for people, and basically just trying to focus on the values that teenagers have and what their interests are in life and what their concerns are. And I really enjoyed writing that article, and it was long enough. I was like, oh, you know, this would make a great book. So after we published it, I started elaborating it and got it to a point where I think it's, you know, a pretty good book. And it needs several more rounds of editing before I can publish it. And I keep thinking I'm going to find those few days of solitude to get that editing done. And it keeps being the case that I can't find them. So that book is basically done and just needs some additional work to wrap up. And I'm hoping to get that out in within the next few months.
Okay.
Thinking in Principles is just hilarious what's happened with that, because that's the book that has become, or the book that has become that, I should say, is the one that I started writing shortly after I finished Loving Life back in 2002. And I've had multiple iterations of that. I've taught workshops on the topic, which have changed the way that I've redounded on the book itself. And I've gone back in and made changes. And then I've taught courses at OSI on this subject. I taught a course on thinking and principles there. And that's made me rethink some of the material in the book. So that is still this massive project that is a couple of times in the past 10 years, I've thought I was at a place where the manuscript was ready for publication. I even published the first chapter of it in the Objective Standard a few years ago. But every time I get back into it and think that I might be near ready to publish it, I realize that there's something I'm unhappy with about it. And so I keep going back into it. And it's just been a, you know, I'm one of these people who prides myself in getting things done, you know.
Well,
this book has been my nemesis in this regard. But here's what I'll say about it. It's going to be better for all the delay. There's no question about that. And it really is, for me, the most important thing I've ever worked on, because I think I've got my head around and I think I'm explaining well in the book what it means to think in principles. What are the elements of this process? And I think it's a crucial thing that Ayn Rand clearly did. If you read through Ayn Rand's works, it's clear that she thought in terms of principles, and she focused on principles, and she discovered principles, and she applied them, et cetera, et cetera. And she even described her method as thinking in principles. That's where I get this phrase. But she never spelled out what is the process of thinking in principles. She did that process, but she never spelled out the elements. So what I have done for now few decades is really studied Ayn Rand's works and what I see as her thought processes in that work, in addition to looking at other really good thinkers who I think in principles, even if they don't realize that's what they're doing. And I've tried to extract from her material primarily and some others as well, what are the elements of this thing so that I can spell them out and concretize them and show people a systematic way to approach this. And that's what the book is or will be ultimately when I publish. I mean, it is already, but it's just not to where I'm ready to hit the switch. So that's that. And I'm really excited about the book as I am frustrated by it.
Well, I haven't attempted that, so I can't understand your emotion, but I kind of get the gist of it. Folks, we've been talking to Craig Biddle. He's the director of the Objective Standard Institute and the executive director of the Prometheus Foundation. We will have all these links in our show notes. Craig, we really appreciate you manning the foxhole with us today. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks.
Very good, Craig. Thank you again for your time. So take care, and hopefully we can talk again someday.
Sounds good. Thanks.
All right.
Thanks. Bye for now.
All right.